this technology is so accessible right now. Like say ChatGPT, we all can access it, which is, this is really powerful. Like I was surprised my dad actually spent an entire day talking to ChatGPT. So this has reached that much that, you know, your people who are not always active on these fronts are actually using this technology. Like, I'm starting a new position. I'm like wondering about how many things I need to be trying to do and what should I be good at. And like, this is always a struggle with yourself. But don't forget to enjoy the part that you are doing, because later you'll look back and you'll only remember the parts that you had fun.
So hello and welcome everyone to who's ever listening to this particular podcast. I have with me Dr. Surbhi Goyal today. She's an assistant professor at University of Pennsylvania. She got her PhD in computer science from UT Austin, and prior to joining UPenn as an assistant professor, she was a postdoctoral researcher at Microsoft Research in New York City in the machine learning group. She has a research expertise in theoretical computer science and machine learning, with a particular focus on developing theoretical foundations for modern deep learning paradigms. She's also a part of building the Learning Theory Alliance community that organizes and conducts several events useful for researchers and students in the career. We'll touch more on these topics in this conversation, but thanks for being on the show, Dr. Goyal. It's nice to have you.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And this is a great thing that you've been doing. I really appreciate the efforts you're putting in.
Thanks. So before we get started, for people who might not know you, like, can you tell a bit about your background and your current research interests that you are working on?
Yeah, for sure. So you already gave a little bit of my introduction, so I can give a even older introduction. So I grew up in India. I did my undergrad in India in IIT Delhi. And after that, I moved to the US to start my PhD. And this was in the year of 2015, and deep learning, I think the deep learning wave kicked off in around 2012. So this was like a super exciting time where, you know, you were seeing all these advances, which now don't seem so big, but, you know, at that time, they were like huge leaps in different areas. So when I started my PhD, I was always interested in math, and I was interested in theoretical computer science, and I had taken courses in machine learning, so that had always made me excited. So I thought this was the perfect opportunity to get into this area of research, which is, you know, developing these theoretical foundations for this new paradigm of deep learning that has suddenly like revolutionized machine learning. So that's what I started with. And what luck had with me, my advisor was also interested in this, so we decided to start working in this space. And since then, it's been now about more than 7.5 years, so that I've been working in this space, and the field has grown a lot, from a few researchers to now a lot of people working in this field and doing very exciting research. So that's been the background of how I got into the space of theory for deep learning. More specifically, the viewpoint that I took for my research was to try to understand what this new function class of neural nets really was. So like taking a very learning theory perspective, in which you take this function class and you try to understand when can you give guarantees of trying to, when you train your network, train your model with this particular function class as your model, what guarantees can you give? What assumptions do you need to get any kind of guarantees that when you train on data that you see the training data that you get, you're going to actually perform well on unseen data that you might see in the future when you apply these models. So I took this simple question and took very simple models, starting with like, understanding even a one-layer neural network, and then going forward, building on that and trying to understand what guarantees we can get, what new algorithms we can devise to get these guarantees. So that was the focus of my research during my PhD. My research tastes have evolved over time, and now I'm looking at various other modern machine learning paradigms like you might have heard of, which are really successful, like these self-supervised learning, these transformer architectures, like you've seen the success of GPT-3. And I mean, I think everybody has access to ChatGPT now. Understanding why this has been so successful, and why is how are we able to achieve all these great advances is something that I've been really interested in these days. So a lot of my research has moved towards focusing on these modern architectures and these modern paradigms of learning, and trying to understand why they work and why they fail, and how can we improve them.
I think I already have a few follow-up questions, but taking one other one step back is most of the people when they get started or get interested about AI is the applications side of AI, right? Like it can do something, it can predict something very nicely. And the other part is much more what you're working on, right? Like the theory, like dissecting why these deep learning models work, which to be honest, like at least from my perspective is like the kind of the boring part of deep learning versus the applied. So I want to know what exactly appealed to you more about the theoretical aspects rather than the applied ML, which is like, I think more than half of the industry or more than that is much more focused on applying to novel or innovative solutions. What made you stick to the mathematical part, which most people get scared of by?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think applications are amazing and they really excite me that this is the potential that this tool has. And it's amazing that people are every day coming up with new you know, modifications and which are achieving all these state of the art results in all these fields. And that is super exciting to me. What motivated me is like, that is really great that all this is happening, but you also see that like many times these models are doing things that are completely unpredictable. They are behaving and making mistakes that, you know, humans would not do, which is fine. I mean, these models are not supposed to behave like humans, but they have their own failure modes. And we really do not understand what is happening. Maybe it's not true now that we have a little bit more understanding than we did when I started out working in this space. So they felt like these black box models that, you know, are doing great. But you know, why are they doing great? And that question like always bothered me that I mean, we have so much rich theory for all of the machine learning models that were used prior to this. There was like provable guarantees, there were like all sorts of amazing, beautiful theory results. And somehow this new paradigm, which was doing so well in practice, had very little theoretical understanding. Though in the 80s, there was a 80s and 90s, there was a lot of work in understanding these neural networks when they were originally proposed. But after that, there was like a winter of that, like nobody was actually working on this. And so that made me like, okay, I want to understand why they work for my own science. Like I want to understand why they are doing what they're doing. So that's what inspired me. Of course, this is a very challenging thing because the practice is like so far ahead of what theory can try to address. But that is like an exciting challenge that how can we find a theory that's very relevant that can actually help with practice instead of theory leading practice. Maybe we can try and assist practice to make it better because there are still like so many things that we don't know. And if you want to use these models in like situations that are, you know, where you really require a certain level of performance and you need certain guarantees, we need to be able to get those guarantees. And they're like all the skills that we have in math is probably useful. And hopefully we can develop new tools to understand, which will advance math as well.
Yeah. And what would you say like helped you the most in building these kind of knowledge base for these kind of things? Because for me, like if I can add is like because of my bachelor's course that I did, bachelor's degree that I did, had little to contribute towards like understanding deep learning models or machine learning models itself. It was only when I started my master's, which was much more focused on computer science, and I specifically tried my best to take courses that helped me like fundamentals of machine learning or statistical learning that helped me understand, okay, like, let me try to create a back propagation on my hand, like using pen and paper. So what was for you? Because I believe even though after that knowledge, I don't feel like I know each and everything, like definitely not guarantees of how a model can converge. So what were the things that you did that may not be a part of a textbook that helped you get to these kind of knowledge base for theoretical models?
That's a really good question. I think machine learning as a field borrows a lot from different other fields, techniques and ideas, which is what makes it very exciting that everybody can work, you know, everybody can bring in their own ideas and add to this field. So getting a full knowledge of this space is obviously challenging. So when I started out working in this space, I had done one course on machine learning in my undergrad, and I had done one topics course on something related like online learning, I guess that was the topic of that course. So I had some background in like understanding how we formulate these problems, what kind of little bit of proof solving of like how to get some guarantees in simpler models. So I had some background before I started. But of course, this was like this whole open space of, you know, where should I start? What should I read? And I wasn't taking a formal course when I started my PhD in, say, learning theory, which is what a lot of my research was. And I never actually ended up taking a course in learning theory throughout my PhD. So a lot of it was like, you know, starting to read papers. You know, I would start reading papers. I would realize I'm getting stuck at this. And then I would be like, okay, how do I get information about this part? And then I would ask around, or I would like search on my own and find like, this is the topic I'm missing. And there's like so many amazing resources of courses that people have been teaching. They've put up their lecture notes. They're, now we have videos because everything was on Zoom for a while. At that time, there weren't that many videos. So reading lecture notes, reading different kinds of material and understanding this was how I started building it. And slowly, you know, you realize like, this is where my knowledge stops. And that's how much I know. And I need something more than that. Then I would spend time, you know, take time away and spend time trying to learn more and talk to other people around me. You know, we had reading groups in our during our PhD where I went and heard what other people were talking about, learned some new skills and trying to adapt from one here to there. One principle that I always followed was like to look at the problem from like as basic as you can. So like, use the tools that are the most basic tools and try to build it up. And you know, where you stop, you're like, okay, now I can't go forward. Then add that knowledge that is missing. So look and search for that. So that's how I did this. Apart from doing this by myself, I also had a lot of support from my advisor who was very willing to, you know, share resources, tell me like what are important things to read, because suddenly if you're like seeing 1,000 papers and you're like, how do I even figure out how to read this, right? So he gave me a lot of pointers. Other people in my field, my peers also gave me a lot of pointers. And attending conferences, workshops, all these things all added up to build this knowledge. And still, I would say I have a specific sphere of knowledge. I don't really have all of the knowledge and I'm still building it. So yeah, this is always a growing journey.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think just to add on to that is like, it makes sense, like what you said, like doing an iterative journey, like when you figure out where you were stuck at and try to get as many resources, information, and then trying to build up a step base. And this is something very much parallel to what my professor once said to me. She has a background in mechanical and industrial engineering. And at the end, now she has joint appointments with deep learning as a like computer science department and radiology. So that's like a completely different pivot of like engineering, I would say. And I asked her once, how did we end up doing like this? So it was more like back in 2013, when she was writing grants, she tried to focus her work towards like AI-based, applied-based research, and then by step by step collaborating with other people, understanding their papers, like their results, it made more sense to her. So yeah, I mean, I love that idea. It's like more like identifying the problems and researching more about it would be the way forward, rather than taking courses. Like courses can definitely help, but these kind of actual hand getting hands dirty phase is very important to learn.
Yeah, and courses are actually very, very important. Like I probably forgot to mention this, but like I did take courses that were not machine learning. Like I took this course on randomized algorithms, where I learned a lot of concentration inequalities, for instance, which have been very useful. Like at that point, I didn't think they would be useful for my research. But I was so glad that I took that course. So sometimes, you know, taking all these other courses, getting your mind out of the techniques that you're used to and seeing some new techniques actually expands the toolkit that you have. So it's actually really important to take these courses as well. You know, when you can't fill the gaps with your own research, it's good to just take the course, because there are so many courses available and every university offers so much.
Yeah. And you also did mention about something that is like, I'm personally very curious, like you did mention that still today we are still learning more about like theoretical aspects of deep learning, as in which parts of the whole architecture, when we have an end-to-end deep learning model, some parts are still like a magical, I would say, like as in they work well, we know it's working well, but we are not very confident why is it working so well. So what kind of things that you would say are currently a quite big question mark, even though based on whatever literature we have out there, versus what were the kind of things that you already know were proved some time back, and now we know how these things are converging from a theoretical aspect of it. So can you give the audience an idea of like, what does these fields, when they focus on getting theoretical guarantees, what does it mean to us as researchers or the outside world?
Yeah, so there are many, many instances of problems that, you know, when you see these models, you train them, you observe some phenomena that is like really fascinating, that's pretty unique to these models that maybe did not exist before, or sometimes it did exist before, but you probably hear appearing again here is an interesting fact. So we can take an example, like maybe this is not directly related to my research, but like, for instance, optimization trajectories these deep learning models. So we train them using these methods, like which are first order gradient methods. Like you do gradient descent, stochastic gradient descent. So you're doing like local improvements every time on to try to find the good global solution that is going to be good on the model. And this is a very highly non-convex problem, very complicated problem, that landscape that you're trying to optimize. And somehow these simple algorithms work really well. And they work really well in practice. And this was a baffling question for theorists, that like, you know, when landscapes are nice, that the problem is like very convex and very very simple, then it's very easy for these algorithms to work. But why should they work in these more complex settings? And there are many other caveats, like these models are bigger than the training data set size, which is this over-parameterized regime. And there you should just completely overfit, but you're still doing well. So these kind of questions were questions that we had no handle on when we started. We did in... To be fair, like there were like this kind of phenomena did occur in previous model machine learning models outside of deep learning, but in the deep learning space, we didn't really know how this was happening. So in the last many years, a lot of researchers in the field have come up with the possible hypothesis and proved in several settings that, you know, there are many reasons why this happens. There is something called implicit regularization, which means that somehow these models, the way they're trained, they implicitly, you know, control the capacity of the model, that they make it, you know, not as rich as it looks, but like it searches in a very small space, which has good solutions. So they're able to get a handle of, you know, prove this for some simple settings. And maybe like, you know, these ideas actually transfer when you see, they create like these diagnostic tools that if you test this out, this maybe this is the right hypothesis. So these kind of ideas we know now more, but still we don't really, with like the models getting bigger and bigger and more complex and doing things that are hard to understand, like imagine ChatGPT, like trying to prove why ChatGPT works is a very monstrous task, right? So we have handle on many ideas, but there is also, with everything we get a new idea of, there's something new baffling that comes up that we don't understand. So there's a lot of questions, but there's a lot of progress also.
Yeah. So I think we already did mention in the whole chat is like transformer models, right? So I think in the last couple of years, or I would even more than that, I would say at least in the language domain, transformers have dominated. And even in vision, like in the last few years, like it has been the favorite child. Like people are preferring transformers at some point or over CNN based models for vision tasks. So can you comment more about like, are there any, like have you any of the research works that you have done try to investigate these two different architectures? Are there any architectural aha moments that make transformers really successful over CNNs and even out of vision tasks? Like they have been very nice for language-based models itself. So what makes, like what is the nice thing that you have noticed about transformer that make it so much preferable by researchers and industry?
So this is a complicated question to ask, that what is exactly pinpoint, like what is the preferable thing? But like one thing that I found very fascinating and something that I've researched on is that they are a different, very different paradigm of how you connect things compared to like convolution neural networks or fully connected neural networks. Here, there is like this dynamic nature where this thing called self-attention, where a particular part of the input can decide what it needs to focus on. So like this is called self-attention, where I can decide, like this part of the image can decide that it needs to attend to this other part of the image. And this is dynamic depending on what the input is. So, and this is a very powerful tool because like for many, maybe like for different tasks, you need different parts that need to focus on different parts. So this part called self-attention is like one of the biggest innovations. And there are many other architectural innovations that have come up that have made this idea actually be successful. And I think that is one core thing that I have spent time understanding, that what is new that this model gives us, this kind of paradigm of computation, instead of like having a fixed convolution structure and connecting them together. Here, you're allowing this to have different weights on different parts of the image instead of the same weight. Yeah, so that has been something that has been a new innovation. And then, of course, scaling them up has, you know, generated all these emergent phenomena that you wouldn't see in small models, you see in big models or with larger training time, that you see that they suddenly can do reasoning tasks, things that you didn't actually train them for. They're able to do these things. That's a very fascinating feature of, this is of transformer architectures itself. Why they are preferred is because they are very successful, right? You try out, like this is some idea that somebody came up. It's a very, very principled idea of generating these attention models, and it really worked well and it gave a big boost, and that's why it's of interest. And not to say that this is the only model, like people are coming up with all kinds of new architectures, which are modifications of these transform architectures. They are using ideas of previous architectures and coming up with new solutions. So we don't know if this is the final model, right? Like there could be a newer model which has a new clever idea that improves this. So that's what I would say. One thing I would point out, like, so I know more on the language side than the vision side. So vision is something that I have not explored that much with. But they're pretty unconventional compared to like traditional language models that we used to have, which were like recurrent RNNs or LSTMs, because they were sequence to sequence models where you would take the whatever input you had some history, and then you would apply the next input and you would process it, so forth. So they were like, you know, over the sequence, they were operating in a recurrent fashion, whereas these transformers are like taking the entire input together and just having a few layers and simultaneously processing this. And that makes it very fast to train compared to the other models, but you're losing this recurrent structure, but still they're able to do these, you know, learn these long range dependencies, understand like, say, in something that if I'm trying to write like a huge block of text, I need to understand what I meant, like maybe 50 or 60 words before, and it's able to capture that. So that's something that this architecture is really able to do well.
Yeah. Just to add to that, I think I did try a few of the transformer models. One of the only limitations, I think, compared to what CNNs they have is even with a smaller or limited data set, CNNs are able to perform better, at least the ResNet, models and all those kind of models that can model these residual networks-based model versus transformers has the given idea that you need a big data set enough to make it train very nicely. Of course, once you have a bigger data set, it can provide some magical insights into the model or whatever downstream task you are targeting at. And one interesting thing that I found out, that which something not I have worked on, but I know the baselines because I have used the same data sets. And hence, what they proved in one of those ideas is the idea of transferability. So if you have a pre-trained model that is trained on a big network, or sorry, big data set, you can fine-tune it very nicely to your downstream tasks, which was previously given the rank to CNN models. But nowadays, like, and this is like the ImageNet moment for medical tasks, at least, because we don't have a big data set. But let's say if someone has, and if they put up a pre-trained model, it can solve a lot of things. So I was like personally very curious about the idea, what makes transformer architecture really good at transferring these knowledges? Because we already know the limitations of CNN models. Label smoothing and all those kind of things don't help you in getting these downstream tasks really accurate. But I'm like, personally, like, this would be something I maybe hopefully can do it as a part of my PhD, is understanding what makes it so much nice. So yeah,
it's even surprising that in context learning, like not even fine tuning, if I add you know, I add some examples in my in context, like in the lines. So like, say I say that I've already taken a trained large language model, and I just put it as an input, I give it an example of some problem, and I ask it to solve it. I'm not training it again, but it is able to solve this by seeing only a few examples of this, right? So it's able to even learn in that form without fine tuning. And this is great, because I guess there's some part of the network that is storing all this information. And when we give it some input, it kind of decides where to focus it on. And now it can like use that to predict. And understanding this is a great thing, because this is very powerful. Because you don't even need to retrain your model. You can just, you know, give it the right prompt and it will generate you the answer you want. And yeah, there's been a lot of interesting work trying to play around with this and see what the limitations are, what they're able to do. And yeah, it's very exciting. Like, the viewpoint that I have taken in my research with my collaborators, my wonderful collaborators, is that, you know, understanding these very, very large language models with the capacity that we have as researchers and the compute we have, it becomes pretty challenging. So we tried to, you know, condense out like what are the things that it's able to do, like, you know, some kind of, say if it's able to do reasoning, how is it able to do reasoning? Like, what does it need to do for reasoning, and try to model that as a synthetic task, like look at a very simple problem and see if it can solve that simple problem, which would also require reasoning, and train these models on these smaller synthetic data sets that you can generate as many samples as you want, because they're like synthetic, and you can train smaller, more concise architectures and see how they perform, and maybe use that as a diagnostic tool to understand like how they're able to do this. And this can give us insights. So that's like one of the directions that I've been looking at, and a bunch of people in this space have been looking at, where we can use, you know, use tasks that we know how to solve, but see how transformers solve them, and maybe they come up with like interesting solutions. How do they learn these solutions, and try to get some theory around that?
Yeah, but a curious question. This is going to be a very highly opinionated question. But I was recently, like, I recently invited a professor, Kambampathy, who is like a very well-known person who works in planning and symbolic AI. And he mentioned this very, very nice thing, that computer science increasingly by day is becoming more like a natural science. meaning there is a model out there, it works well, and now there is a whole community who is trying to debug, like, why does the model work well? Which is very contrary to what engineering disciplines normally do work like, right? Like, we have a system that works, and then we improve it so that, like, it can, we never question, like, why a database management system works. Like, we know how these things, retrieval works and all those kind of things. Do you ever wonder, like CNNs, when it came out, it worked very well, and then there was, like, at least 3 or 4 years trying to understand what it is doing well and how it is doing well. And then it came like SHAP, Lime, and Gradient Explainer, and blah, blah, blah stuff that can explain these saliency maps and a lot of techniques. Now we have transformers, and there is a whole community trying to understand why do the transformers work. Do you ever find that very, something on the wrong track? Or like, do you feel that is a completely fine way of proceeding with research?
Yeah, I guess there's no right and wrong in research, right? That's like, it's unexpected. We are trying new things, and what works can be from this side or that side. So there is no guarantee. As long as we're making progress, it's good, right? Mm-hmm. So definitely, like, it's changed around from what it was before, but that's always exciting, that if something is working really well, then, this is a challenge for us as, the humans and researchers, that something that we didn't expect to work really well, or we thought that this could work well, and it suddenly did really work well. Because the scales are very different, right? Like, we have so much data, we have so much compute, we've like really advanced on these two things. And maybe our understanding of these two things hasn't advanced at the same level, right? Like that what this actually entails, like having that much data fed into a model that can actually process that, like the entire of Wikipedia and all the text that you have in the world, like if it can process that, like the kind of information, the scale that it's running at is so huge that it's probably, you know, something we couldn't even fathom, like maybe 20 years ago, that we would ever be able to train these gigantic models. So I think of this as an exciting thing. Definitely the role of theory always comes into question, that what can theory provide here in this space? But, you know, if you actually understand the tools better, you can develop better and newer tools. Like, you know, you can go back to any example in history where we had the technique first. Maybe we had fire, but we didn't know how to control fire. So we need to control fire or any kind of tool. So it's always, it's a new challenge, and it's pretty exciting. And we're all figuring this out, like how to proceed and how to come up with great ideas. The one thing to always note is that these models are doing well, but they have a lot of problems. And we are seeing these problems surface in all kinds of situations, right? So but when there are problems, means there are challenges that we need to solve, and we need to use all the tools that we have to solve this. So I believe everybody should put in the effort from all kinds of different disciplines, and hopefully all of us together can come up with some solution.
Yeah. And you did mention about the scale and gigantic models, right? So there has been a recent trend that everybody's noticing, that instead, like, that was a time, at least in 2018 or so, I would say, like, people would criticize if the models or data sets are being used by a certain amount of computational complexity. They would report that in the last sections that, these were the computational power. But nowadays, it seems like to be a trend, like, okay, big models, like, that is the way forward. And people are trying to make the parameters as big as possible, because, of course, the performance is at the most important metric that we are trying to optimize for. So do you think, like, in terms of, because you have been working on the theoretical aspects of understanding how these deep models work, so in that case, would you think that this trend has to be continued, or would you think that there should be a way forward to building more efficient architectures? Or do you think that from a theoretical standpoint, more data means more parameterized models, because we cannot condense all of this information into a very small parameter model? What does it make sense from a theoretical standpoint?
So that's a really good question, and it's a big debate that's existing in our community, that whether scaling is the solution. It is obviously providing, like, really like I mentioned before, emergent behavior, that when you keep scaling up, it is, when you're training it to do only, like, say maybe next word prediction, it's starting to learn all these reasoning and all these world models, which is very exciting. But it does seem like an unsustainable way forward, because there's a limit to how fast we are growing on our compute and how large we can make these models, where, you know, now there's a divide that only certain parts of the research community can actually, you know, even train these models. Now the industry and research academia have this divide, like what kind of resources we have access to. There's only so much we can do. But it seems like, you know, there could be more efficient ways of doing this. This is the hope, right? Like, this is a model we came up with, we trained, we threw a lot of data, we scaled it up, it is doing great behavior. But if we get a better understanding of it, maybe we can condense it to a smaller network, or we can develop, you know, better algorithms to train them that do not require these huge models. Another thing that is always a challenge is that, you know, right now, with larger models also, there's a lot of effort put into making, you know, hardware really good for training these large models. So designing new algorithms and designing new approaches requires to develop the hardware also to match the scale of how well these are doing right now. So this is all like a hope that eventually, like, I think there is definitely scope, even from a theoretical perspective or any practical perspective, that you would hope that there are models that are not, we don't need to keep scaling up infinitely to get better and better performance, but maybe we can have more principled ways of getting the performance that we want from smaller models. And maybe this is a good way to, like, right now, at least the bigger models, we are getting some idea of what is possible, right? And we can hope to try to distill this in a smaller model. And there's a lot of research, active research of trying to figure this out. Like you said, that maybe if we have so much data, then we need some way for the model to be able to store all this data. So we need all this big capacity, but maybe not. Maybe we know how, like, computer systems work. There's a memory unit, right? You can have a way to access memory instead of, like, actually having to store everything. And this is something that is true. Like, there are people who are working on this space to try to figure out how to access memory instead of, like, having it stored in the network. And there are many, many ideas. There are a lot of ideas. And let's see, hopefully, you know, some of my ideas will also work in this space and come up with more concise versions of these models.
Yeah, definitely. That's the hope. Yes. And you didn't mention about reasoning that has been possible using these large models. So can you briefly, like, me being a very naive, understand, like, I understand reasoning from an AI model just like as a layman person can understand, as in I should be able to understand why the model is giving me certain predictions and I'm able to reason why not this. So there are approaches like counterfactuals and other things that have been proposed that can maybe pseudo help you into understanding the model's predictions. So can you, like, briefly maybe explain what reasoning means when we say in the context of deep learning model, and how do we approach this problem from a standpoint of theoretically understanding can deep learning can really reason these predictions?
Yeah. So when I meant, what I meant by reasoning was that the fact that, you know, if we, with these large language models are, if you give them a problem, which requires, like, multiple steps of reasoning to come up with a solution, like, say, think of, like, you know, when you did, like, some entrance exam, you had a question that required, like, 2-3 steps for you to figure it out. So you reasoned that this is the statement, then you came up with one step and second step and so forth. So this is something that behavior that I was talking about, that these large language models are actually able to reason to get their solution. So I think there are many instances of this. For example, like, I think Minerva is a is a version that's taught on math problems, and it can actually solve many math problems. And it can, I forget which country it is, but maybe it's a Poland's entrance exam, and it does get better than a lot of humans' performance, which is like, you know, these are tasks that you think are require reasoning, where, you know, I need to reason and I need to go through a reasoning chain to come up with a solution. It's not just like I see an image and I want to see if this is a dog or not. Maybe that also requires some steps of reasoning, but something like more complex tasks. So that's what something transformers are really good at. And trying to understand how they're able to reason is very useful, because, you know, maybe their reasoning doesn't look anything like how humans reason, but there is some kind of reasoning in which it's coming up with a solution by doing these steps. So that is what I meant by reasoning. So something that I have been looking at is, like, you know, trying to, like I said before, looking at a synthetic setup. So with my collaborators, we looked at this rich family of models, which are called automata, in which basically you have a particular state, you take an action and you go to another state, and then you take an action, you go to another state, and you model this. And this is a simple, like, there are only few actions and there are only few states you can go to. And say you get a sequence of these actions that you've taken so far. So think, like, one example could be you're driving a car around a roundabout, and there are two actions that you have. You can either go forward or you can flip your car around, which is probably not possible practically, but imagine for that instance. Yeah. And I just tell you, like, a sequence of these actions that, okay, I went forward, then I flipped, then I went forward, then I flipped. And at the end, I ask you, where are you now in this, you know, this roundabout? And now for you to like think about this task, you'll be like, you'll reason, okay, this is how, okay, this is the action that happened. If I trace the whole path, I would be here, right? Yeah. So this kind of, we've taken this kind of a problem in a more general sense and seen how transformers reason about this. How can they actually predict? And they do really well. And their reasonings are very different. They take, what we observed was they take shortcuts. They don't actually do this computation the way we are doing it. They find shortcuts on how to do this. And you can actually quantify this theoretically, like how they can find shortcuts. So one thing is good that shortcuts, they can solve the problem, but there are problems with that because then they can't generalize outside. You know, if I give a longer sequence, they were trained on these smaller sequences and they're good on finding shortcuts there, but they might not do really well after. So these are like some ways of trying to understand that. But yeah, there's a lot more. This is just the flavor of something that I'm trying to understand in this reasoning space. But generally understanding how they're doing reasoning is a very, very interesting question. And further improving the capability to reason would be very useful.
And just to follow up to that example that you mentioned about the roundabout. So in that case, in parallel to what you did, so would it also make a lot of difference on the, like in that case, you gave me some examples, right? Like I can either keep on driving straight versus right or left. So those were the intermediate points that you would have like a, you know, like hook to those points, as in like, what were the decision-making criteria for those? So I assume in your work that you did for transformers, you would also define certain kind of states in between, right? So would it also matter like what states you are defining for that particular framework to reason would also vary a lot, right? Like the results that you get, you said like transformers are taking shortcuts, but it could be the case that the states are not well defined or maybe not properly defined. Would that matter a lot in that kind of work? Or I'm just curious, like just a probing question.
So in our work, we kind of started with assuming that there is a state action table, that this, if you perform this, you will go to this state and this action. It's just that the model did not ever get access to that. The model only saw actions and saw that what was the state that it reached. And so now it had to learn this model of how the world is. So this is an example of, imagine that, you know, there is some model of the world. Think in reinforcement learning, you assume that there's some model of the world and you're trying to understand this model of the world. And we were able to find that transformers are able to understand the model of this world. It's just not the way that we would probably do it. They're doing it in their own way, which is maybe sometimes we also find shortcuts, but that's kind of what we were trying to do. So in that setting, we were in a very limited setting where we assumed there was a true model to start with. And then we saw what transformers were learning. And there's a lot of questions there that maybe, you know, we can interpret like what kind of solutions they've learned, understand that are they actually learning the shortcuts that we think they're learning, or they're learning something more interesting. And something very fascinating there in that research that surprised me was that we came up with a solution. We came up with a setup where we thought the transformers would not be able to work ever. We thought that this is too hard for it to do a shortcut solution for, and it found a shortcut solution. And we were very surprised because we couldn't find a shortcut solution for that. And then we were like, we kind of backtracked, like try to understand what the transformer is learning. And that helped us figure out what the solution was. So in some sense, the transformer taught us something new.
Interesting. Yeah. These are the kind of things I think that excites most of the people. And I think in the bigger picture, I think when the first AlphaGo or whichever the game, like the Go based model that came out, like if people were trying to reason like what each of the moves meant, like, so most of the moves did not make sense to any Go player, which like he or she might take at that particular instance, but it was trying to understand the longer game of the other person's playing the model. So yeah, that was like these are the kind of insights that really trigger us and makes us worried about, like, me being a person who works on these kind of models at times, I feel, yeah, these are not dangerous. But when I see these kind of insights, I get like why the media articles and other things, when people hype up the idea that is AI getting dangerous or something, it makes more sense, like that, yes, why is it becoming more smarter than what it has been designed to? So, but like coming to that question, and I'll tie this particular thread into the next question, is precisely like the most triggering question that I can ask anyone on this show is, we always see these media articles, like people getting, like, there are two kind of people who would typically post articles whenever something new AI systems comes out, is like one that is appreciating, and then there are 10 other articles that says, should we be worried about AI because it's trying to do something that we cannot comprehend or we cannot understand? So I want to know, and I'll tie in again a few other articles that says AI along the lines of AGI versus consciousness, sentient AI, if you remember, I think maybe a year back or so. So these kind of claims, and you being working on the theoretical standpoint, do you ever think, like, do you ever think about these topics concretely? Like, does it really make sense on we are progressing towards AGI consciousness and all those kind of things? Or are these very loosely defined philosophical or psychological terms that has little to do with technical frameworks?
Yeah, so this is a tough question to answer because this is completely opinion based, right? Of course, these models are doing like really exciting things and really great things. And with Go, they have came up with strategies that were not very human-like. And I think that creates a fear in humans when they don't understand from their mental model why models are behaving the way they do. And there's no reason for these models to behave in a way that is human-like, because you're just training them on, you know, this is the input, this is the output we want, this is what the task needs to be done. You're not ever saying that be like a human when you're training this task. Not that there are some models which are trying to do imitation more of human behavior. So yeah, definitely it can be scary because sometimes, you read some articles are actually very real, right? Like the Tesla, for instance, like there are some crashes that are very evident that they were like mistakes that a human would never make, but the AI made, right? Yeah. Whereas the AI might not have made a mistake on something that a human would have made, for sure. But these things are scary because, you know, we're actually this technology is so accessible right now. Like say ChatGPT, we all can access it, which is, this is really powerful. Like I was surprised my dad actually spent an entire day talking to ChatGPT. So this has reached that much that, you know, your people who are not always active on these fronts are actually using this technology. Same with true with DALL-E, for instance. Like everybody was generating images and it's become very accessible. So of course this worry surely comes in that the more powerful these systems get, the more impact they can have in our society, right? Like, and they need to be, we need to really have some guardrails around what is feasible, what is not. And we don't really understand everything it's doing. And sometimes it produces results that are not not good. Now, saying whether it's conscious or not is a very statement that I cannot make. This is very hard to say, but it is really getting, what I would say is getting really good at many tasks. And it's not clear, like in the next 15 years, what are the tasks that it might not be able to do. And that doesn't mean it has consciousness, but it just means that it can do a lot of tasks that humans can do. And at that point, we all have to think about what that world looks like and how we deal with it. With any technology that is so new, like even when the internet came out, like it changed the whole societal fabric, right? And so this will also do that. And I think we have wonderful people who are trying to think about from all different fields. We need like sciences, we need social sciences to actually think about what the repercussions of these things are. And it's really important for any technology to think about what the repercussions of the technology are and have these discussions and these debates and figure out what. And this requires like maybe policy, requires other aspects of things that I'm not an expert on. And there are many people who are better experts on these to figure out how we'll keep this technology, how will we keep it being useful for humans instead of like agnostic to humans or like, I mean, not agnostic, adversarial to humans. So yeah, I think I'm personally, for me, I'm very excited about all these new advances that are coming about because suddenly the opportunity is so huge of what we can do and how we can help so many people. Like one of the examples that I'm really, since I started teaching for the first time this semester, like the power of these models, if they were actually very accurate as good teachers to places where we don't have resources, could like actually, you know, share knowledge. And like, there's like a lot of positive potential of these models. Communicating could like really help and could change the whole landscape of education where you're not searching for Google for questions and hoping you'll get an answer. Instead, you can have an interactive conversation and, you know, discuss where you are not understanding, and these models can actually help you with that. And that kind of power is, it's very powerful. But yeah, we have to play with fire, really. We have to protect ourselves too. So I think both sides are very valid.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think before I think DALL-E and ChatGPT came, even I was on the along the lines of like, maybe, yeah, regulations, we need that. But like these models are pretty harmless, like because it's very hard to use, hard to train, and hence they are not very well built. But I think when DALL-E and ChatGPT came, and if you follow the thread of how people have been using, creators have been using, it's very much out of control. And this is like the high time where regulations and other things have to be in place so that people really can be like you said, like guardrails for these kind of models. But I also do agree, like you said, like your father using ChatGPT, like one of my brothers who has a PhD in genetics, like he's a brilliant guy and he's trying to learn more on the Python side. Like he's working on genomic data, so he wants to understand how I can use these logistic regression models, and he has no background in computer science. But he said, like, he was in ChatGPT, like, he could train a model that he had no knowledge on using Python, like scikit-learn or any other kind of libraries. And he was able to do that in 3 days. So I was like, wow, then that's like a completely good use case. Yeah, like if, yeah, if he would have been...
GitHub Copilot, for instance, I think a couple of people I know personally who are not in this ML space at all have used it, and they found like their time being saving a lot of time. Of course, it's the opposite worry that the jobs are going. so we have to figure out a new. We have to embrace that this is existing. This is a new technology that's come in, and it has its potential. And we have to think of a world where we actually accept it instead of like trying to run away from it. We have to accept the existence of this, like how we accepted Google, for instance, at that time when Google search came in. Like that was probably surprising for everybody. So now this is surprising, and we are in this new world, which is exciting. So we have a lot of problems to figure out. But I'm excited to see how people use these technologies, like especially when you give it access to people outside of the research community. Now that creators are using this, they are creating like all kinds of interesting things. I'm always surprised, like when I go online and I see that they came up with this crazy idea. I was like, when I was trying, I couldn't even think of like 100 questions to ask that would be that exciting, the questions people are asking ChatGPT. So definitely it's very exciting and scary. For sure.
But that ties to me a very student-friendly question. So like, an alert would be like, we are done with all more technical questions. So definitely I'll ask more simpler questions. Is one of the biggest problems that I would say, like we briefly started in the same time, but at least you started your journey in deep learning and AI slightly earlier, like you said, in 2015. Like I started in 2020. And one thing that I feel when you get started in this field, there's a plethora of resources that people can get bombarded with. And it's very easy to navigate your interest, like let even say finding a topic to work on, like letting your interest flow into what has been done from the research and what you want to contribute on. So first, my first question is, do you feel there is a lot amount of research being published every day, I would say now, because now I follow at least few people and they post out archive papers more than I post on Instagram. So I think like it's very hard to keep up with good work, and they're fantastic works because they have done extensive experiments and everything. So first of all, do you feel that? And secondly is, how do you keep up? How do you make sure that you are not missing out any of the work, so that like when you want to build your idea, you're citing the perfect baselines that make more sense? And any tips for reading these papers? Because it's frankly very hard to keep up.
Yeah, this is a very tough question and I don't have an answer, but I'll tell you what I do myself. Yes, definitely there are a lot of papers. So if you think about it, we have just in the ML space, not even counting like just core ML, not even counting like vision conferences, language conferences, we have NeurIPS, ICML, iClear, AI Stats, and the list goes on. And NeurIPS had about 2,500 papers, if I'm not wrong. And ICML had like probably like a smaller scale, and so has iClear. And like, this is obviously not humanly possible to process all of this data. So of course that becomes trickier. So you can't hope to keep up with everything that's happening in the world. So definitely that's a very big goal that we probably won't achieve. In the area that you work in, you can try to be connected to the researchers that you like, whose work you've been following. You can, create a network of people who are interested in same areas where you share papers and you talk about, the ideas they found interesting. Like, you know, if every day, say you read something interesting and you shared it with your friends around who were in that, I found this paper interesting, that's going to get them to, read that. Of course, this creates some bias that, people who are famous, their papers get circulated more, whereas newer papers are harder, but hopefully, the right kind of work eventually gets publicity. And you get to know that. So it is definitely a challenging thing. One thing, for me, tools-wise, Google Scholar has helped a lot. So Google Scholar gives these recommendations that have gotten better and better over time. And I often find very useful papers. So somehow, like, I tested this out a little bit, that the recommendations I was getting, they're usually delayed by a week, I think. And the recommendations I was getting from my collaborators and people in my network matching up pretty well. So I thought that that's a good way. And there you can follow researchers. So you can click on the researchers whose work you've liked. And whenever they post an article or their related research, you can get notification. And that helps you get a curated version. And then you can, one thing that I learned from one of the younger students I worked with, she is super organized. And every time she reads a paper, she writes down like a quick TLDR of that paper and whatever she thinks this paper connects with. And that kind of graph is created where, you know, you can always go back to this graph and see what all is connected. I have not gotten to do this, but I really want to do something like this. And if something we create like this, we can share, which makes people's easier to, you know, navigate and add to, these things could help. But yeah, it is definitely a very challenging problem. And I think everybody suffers from this, that it can be very overwhelming to open archive and see 1,000 things, and very intimidating. So yeah, so you have to just create your own metric of what paper you find interesting and be able to like pick out the papers and spend time, you know, skim reading them, then deciding, you know, you have to be very conservative about what, where you spend your energy. So you can skim read a lot of papers, just filter them out, then do a little bit deeper, then filter out, and then do an in-depth study for a few papers, because it's not possible to do that for everything.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I completely agree that. And I think over the few years that I started my PhD, the way how I first read the paper has changed a lot. Like initially, I would be the person who would read the abstract and blah, blah, like the very chronological order of a paper. Yeah. But versus now, it's like for me, the other way around, like I'll see the figures first, the results that they are claiming for. And if it makes sense, like mostly I'll be reading a paper where I know the results, what it stands for. And then if the results make sense, I'll go to the abstract, like are they really suggesting what they are claiming for. And yeah, apart from that, I think what you said like totally makes sense. And one addition to that, like for me, reading groups has been like the best way to get updated to these works, because it's very hard, like at least having a close community of at least 4 or 5 people who, you know, their summaries make sense to you and your summary makes sense to them. Having that group really helps at times, and also getting updated to some of the works that I frankly would have missed, or maybe I would have learned like 3 months later, and sometimes they catch these works. So yeah,
for your listeners, I would say like if they're just starting out on this journey, like it gets easier. Like initially it is very overwhelming to read a paper. You spend like hours and hours and days on a paper because you're trying to understand every little thing of that paper. And then slowly you realize that you don't need to understand everything of the paper. You want to understand only the idea that the paper. So you should understand the problem they're addressing, why they're addressing, and what their solution is. So as long as you understand that, then you can pick and choose, you know, which papers, ideas you actually want to dive deep into. And that reading over time with practice, it becomes faster and faster. So like by this stage, you know, I've seen this grow in myself also, like how much time I take to read a paper to abstract out what the key idea is has gotten much faster, also because my knowledge has increased, right? So this is always a journey. Another thing, very creative solution that somebody has, people have come up with, is that they put their paper into ChatGPT and ask for a summary. So maybe they try that.
Yeah, actually, like a very funny thing happened just 2 days back. One of my lab mates said like he was trying to proofread a paper before sending to the advisor, and he inputted to the ChatGPT, and ChatGPT to kind of summarize, because that's what it's really good at, like summarizing that paper. And it, he actually used, because he had an abstract of around 300 words, like, but the abstract had to be 250 words. So he actually used, and he actually used more than 90% of what ChatGPT summarized, because they did it so very nicely. And they actually like, so ChatGPT also points out few things that it thinks that could be wrong. This is what, like, are you trying to mean something? And that was like a typo, like that was like not even like a spelling mistake, but the whole definition of that word was wrong. So I was like, wow, this is something. Yeah, really,
you can like, use it. You just have to use the technology that you have in the way. I use it to create my emails now, which is wow. Yeah, I think everybody's using it in the way that they find useful. But yeah, that could maybe help with the, you know, summarization would be very useful to keep up with the literature. But yeah, you have to embrace the fact that you can't keep up with everything. This is the boon, this is the curse of being in a field that is very popular. But it's really great that you're working in a field that is very popular because people care about what you're doing. So yeah. I think it works both ways. Yeah.
Yeah. But talking about overwhelming and life getting easier once you get started with it, if someone were to ask like who should do a PhD, like who would you think would make an ideal candidate for PhD versus who should consider doing a PhD, like if you were to reflect back on your own self, like what were the factors that you considered while enrolling yourself into PhD? Like I'm sure a thought would have come into your mind, like should I go into a research position in the industry and then balance out my other financial factors versus the pure core love for your research? So if you want to reflect back, and now that you're a professor, I think it might have a bias for like slighting, hinting, like inclining towards PhD. But if you were to reflect back on a fair point, who would you say makes an ideal candidate for PhD?
Yeah, so this is there's no ideal candidate, right? Like there is nothing, there's no one fits all phenomena here. It really depends on, what kind of area you're in, what kind of interests you have, what kind of motivations you have. So I think one thing that's really important is to actually know what a PhD really entails, right? Which you can get from information from talking to people who are doing this, or reading. Like there are a lot of like nice accounts of, who should do a PhD, or like articles about how a PhD is like. So if that is something that fits with the idea of life that you want, and is something that you're really excited about and you're passionate about, that's the way to figure this out. And there are lots of opportunities. There are lots of questions to think about, like financial constraints, the kind of lifestyle you want, the kind of things you are more passionate about, right? Like, so I think this really is very personal on whether you should do a PhD or not. If you are really excited by the research you're reading, you're like, oh, I want to do this research, I want to work with these people, and then if they are in academia, then that's like something that you would really thrive on. And it's also the whole PhD process is not like, it's always like an up, it is always up and down. Sometimes you're very, very, you're doing really well, sometimes you're not doing really well, and this is like a journey, which is true for every job that you do. So I think the PhD experience of everybody is different, and whether they like it, they don't like it, can also vary a lot. What I would say is, like, if you're deciding and if you're not sure whether you want to do a PhD, a good idea would be to, read up, like, who you're trying to, work with, read up a little bit of their work, talk to their students, see what like life would look like doing that PhD, see if you're actually very interested in this research area. Are you willing to spend a lot of time thinking about problems in this space? Does that make you happy? Does that excite you? And decide based on that. Because nowadays, at least in the field of machine learning, there's a lot of opportunity, even in industry, to do great work with great impact. And there's a lot of opportunity as a researcher, to like as a PhD student also, like to do great work and great impact. So it really depends on what is your interest. And it sometimes feels very overwhelming that, you're committing for 5 years of your life. But I will say that the PhD time is like the time that you're the most free to decide what you want to do with your time. And I think that time you don't get back. So you do suffer the cost of financial choice that you make, but you also get this amazing freedom to do what you want to do and figure out what you're interested in. And I think that is a really big positive. Having said that, there is also it is a stressful process. Everybody goes through this, the stresses of a PhD life, and that is also a reality of doing a PhD, and having a good support circle is always very useful for that.
Yeah, I think most of the people when I talk to, like, the first reaction that I get, like, when I try to say them, yeah, I enrolled into a PhD program, most of them are scared of the commitment part rather than the other aspects of it. Like, but being committed to one topic or one idea of student life and exploring the idea of research is very intimidating most of the times. But you mentioned something about, like, lifestyle or whatever end goal you have after doing your PhD should matter the most while deciding whether to get a PhD or not. So one question would be is, if like most of the people who want to work in AI, like, are more interested on applying part of these AI. So if I want to get a job that heavily focuses on AI-based products or AI-based services, I want to get a PhD because most of these roles are very sophisticated. So do you think if the end goal is to get into an industry which is more focused on AI or machine learning or any other paradigms, is getting a PhD very important, you still feel, as of 2023? Or do you think, because I've seen a lot of people transition to these roles over a period of time. So you join as a whatever degree that you have, but over some time you work on these projects and you are later transitioned to a research scientist or a researcher. So what do you see the trend? Like, do you still see PhD to be really important?
So before that, like, let me just correct. I don't think that you should have the end goal in mind, like what your life will look like after the PhD. You should obviously, it's really important to enjoy the journey. So if you're not going to be excited about doing the PhD, then it's probably not the best fit, because you have to do that journey, and then you get what you get. So it's important to enjoy that journey, anything that you're doing. For the question about whether a PhD is relevant, if is it needed? there are all examples. There are examples of people who are doing great work who have no PhDs. There are people, examples of people who are doing great work who have PhDs. And there is a skill, there's a certain skill that a PhD helps you develop, which is like you're really figuring out how to think of what is the right problem to work on. And I'm dealing with the uncertainty of that there is no knowledge in this area. And I'm trying to push the boundaries of existing knowledge in this space and, you know, figuring out this is the right question to ask and this is the way that question needs to address. And going through a PhD of like spending that much time in a structured way, just thinking these kind of questions is a skill that is useful for a lot of research roles. And that's why like it's something that people look for in industry as well. This is, of course, changing a lot because the applications of with deep learning coming in, the fact that, you know, there's so many tutorials in the world that anybody can train a model today if they just spent enough time, you know, doing that research. So the starting point of research has become very accessible. But before that, imagine like if you were trying to do research in like, say, a theory of some particular part of computer science, you would need to know a lot of information that only coursework would provide you or like, you know, having gone through this whole experience would provide you. So definitely the landscape has changed. So it really depends on what the person's interests are. If they really want to have that five to 6 years of like focused energy on like just learning and learning these skills and, you know, coming up with new, really pushing the knowledge, then, you know, PhD is the way to go. And then you can go into industry if you want. After, you can go into academia, you have a lot of options. Or you can do the other way around. I have very, very good friends who have actually gone the other route, who've started as like, you know, just started as software engineers after their undergrad. And then so slowly over the years today are doing research roles in all these companies and are working on very exciting things. So both paths are very valid. Of course, at the current time, the industry is going through a low point where hiring and all that is not that feasible. Like it's really reduced. So things are changing. So we'll have to see, wait and see what industry looks like in a little bit. And definitely if any area becomes very exciting, lots of people want to get into it. So there's a lot more competition. Definitely what edge you have always helps.
Yeah. No, that completely makes sense. And like that was the first point, like as in deciding whether to do a PhD or not. And the second spot, like I'm sure you must have gone through, and that is like my current phase in my PhD, is like deciding a good thesis point. So what were the points that you considered previously, but now looking back, once you have a thesis, you obviously went through the job interviews in academia industry. So now if you were to reflect back, like what were the things that you think makes an ideal PhD thesis, like in terms of CS job market, whether it be industry or academia? Do you think like we should be focused on at least few points that most people might not be considering when we are making a thesis on our research topic?
Yeah, so I think how the process really works is usually in the first few years, you are working on some project ideas and a lot of maybe your ideas come from your advisor or people around you. And then at some point you reach that, you cross that stage and now you're like ready to be like, now I can think of the problems I want to work on. And this is like where you kind of sit and think that what is the thing that I'm interested in? And then you decide like, this is the kind of area that I would want to focus on. And then you create your thesis around that. There's no always one path. Like sometimes what this happens is naturally you ended up starting working in this space and you started liking that space. And then that became your idea. Sometimes you change around, your interests develop, you move around and you decide to create a different topic. Maybe in your third year, you could switch your topic completely. That also happens. So an ideal thesis is a little challenging to say, but like anything that creates like, you know, a new space of new ideas, it could be a new ideas. It could be a new problem. It could be a new way of looking at a problem. It could be many different things where, you know, you've kind of condensed something that was not what existed before. And there is a new viewpoint that you've added that is your personal viewpoint. So after doing your PhD, you should be that expert in that particular area that you have chosen. You are the expert of that area. So a good PhD thesis would look like, you know, this is the problem statement that I took, or this is what I did. Why was the motivation for why I chose this? You would write that in your thesis, convince why this is an important problem, come up with what tools you came up with, new tools. And then a good way would be to like, why are these tools useful? Like what else can they do in the future? So like that, if that journey exists in your research space, then that could comprise, you know, make a good PhD thesis. And or to know this is not all on you. You have your advisors, you have a lot of people on your committee. They're all going to guide you through this process to like what to, you know, answer this question of what makes a good PhD thesis. And they will help you with that process that, you know, this part is missing in your, you know, to make a complete picture, this is something that you should think about. And then you'll add that. And it's a journey of doing this. For some people, this is sometimes always clear from the start that this is the problem they want to work on and this is what they want to do. So for them, that thesis becomes like a, you know, linear direction. Just go attack this problem, work as hard as this problem. For some people, it might be more different that they're more exploratory. They take some time and then they come up with this particular formulation. And then they're like, okay, this is the problem I really care about. And this is something that really inspires me and I want to work on this. And that could be that. Sometimes it's also that you ended up working on a lot of things, which there was some mind in your, something in your, you know, latent state that you were actually going towards some direction, but you just didn't know that. And once you stop and you look back and you're like, okay, this is where I was going all this while. And then suddenly it becomes clear to you that this is what I was, you know, trying to achieve. And then all of these are valid ways in which, you know, your thesis can come about. But take help of everybody around you. Ask or ask this. You're not alone on this journey. There are a lot of people who have gone through this who can help you out. So if you're struggling with what your PhD thesis should look like, you know, take the help of these resources.
Yeah. And I'm curious, like, did you have any pitfalls that you would like maybe share with people that may like it is like an obvious pitfall that people can avoid that maybe you went through or maybe someone around you went through that people can avoid during like it could be either related to your like, thesis statement, defining those theses, like you said, like you had that latent idea in mind, but maybe to grasp it better so that you can be on that track much more faster. Are any in general pitfalls towards your research journey overall that you would recommend to people?
Yeah, so I think okay, not a pitfall, but I would say some things that would be helpful. So one thing that we always shy away from, but it's actually useful to just like every maybe year end or at some point, like decide to sit down and write like a style of a research statement, like what kind of research are you doing, what your goals are. So sometimes when you sit and think about this, you actually, you know, when you allocate time, because sometimes what happens is you're in this rush of like, I want to be productive, I want to do new things, I want to just work on my projects, but you sometimes stop and don't think about why you're doing this, right? So I think it's very good and useful exercise to sit down and write this, maybe in a more formal way, like write a research statement, because this will anyway be useful for you when you apply for fellowships, you apply for jobs, you need a research statement. So, you know, writing that down, it is very, very, you know, scary to get yourself to do that, but it's actually a very useful exercise because it helps you recollect your thoughts. And doing that, you know, periodically, maybe not every year, maybe every few years, but like doing that is very useful to like, you know, make a sense of what you've been doing and like think about what is the next thing you want to do and be more, you know, deliberate and intentional about what you're going to work on. So I think that is something very useful. And the other thing generally is useful is to go talk to people. I think you're always somehow like I had this thing that I had a really strong imposter syndrome when I was starting out. And I was like not confident, like, you know, I can't go to somebody and talk to them because what will I say to them? What will I tell them that, you know, they don't know and maybe I won't know anything interesting to say, but that's not true. You know, you always have something interesting to say because they don't know what you know. And you don't know what they know. So it's always useful. So, you know, doing that is very important. So going and talking about your ideas, talking about what you're doing, asking what they are doing, like it's always useful to like expand your knowledge. And when you talk about your idea to somebody else, you're actually condensing and creating like, you know, the elevator pitch of your idea. And that helps you with a lot of clarity in, you know, coming up with your, what is that I'm working on, you know? So when you're talking to your collaborators, you're like, they all understand that problem. But when you talk to somebody new, you have to explain that problem. So that and giving talks and all these things is always very useful to condense the ideas. So I think I would just recommend you to take all opportunities. Every opportunity that you miss is a missed opportunity that you could have taken. So take as many as you can and create them for yourself.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'll just add to both of these points because I love these two points. The first thing that you mentioned is like maybe journaling, like this is like maybe I personally do journaling for my other personal aspects, but like what you suggested was journaling for your research statement. And it kind of makes more sense because I think few semesters back, like at least in ASU, what we have over here is like every semester, if you're taking research credits, you have to like fill out a different form to get these credits. And there is a justification form of around, I think 300 words or something like that. So where you have to say what is your end goal for taking these research credits. And in a way, that professor would say that, okay, type down whatever things you want to focus on your thesis and do that. But it is more like a very formal requirement. We don't really focus a lot on that particular research statement, but still, like, in some ways, professors try to politely say that, please fill out as much as accurate possible. And I think few semesters back, when I was writing the new one, I just got the template from the old one because we are just trying to change a few things. And I realized there were a lot of things that I proposed, but I never did work on them. And that was the time I realized, okay. And then I collected all my past six semesters, these research statements, as in, like, what did I start with? Because it's very easy to forget in the last 2 years, what was my first goal when I started working with this professor on or this project, how it got evolved, because it changes very quickly, right? Like, because if the results don't make sense, we pivot to a different topic. So yeah, it kind of makes a lot of sense what you said, like journaling at some periodic time. It can help you get a better trajectory and overview perspective. And the second part you mentioned, networking. I mean, yeah, I like, at least I have been doing this, like, at least these podcasts itself have helped me a lot, because talking to people from NLP domains, reinforcement learning, managerial roles, program manager, these other kind of people who are directly or indirectly working on AI problems, it has influence. And the biggest influence that I think I had is back in COVID when I started my PhD, because of these podcast that I had, like, someone from the physics department reached out to me because they wanted to implement a CNN-based model for detecting, like, tissue damage. And he was from biophysics domain, so he had literally no knowledge of working on these projects. And we eventually did that. So we implemented a ResNet-based segmenting model. It was very easy for me. But when I was talking to him, like, the way he was collecting these problems at histopathological slides and all those kind of things, he was actually mentioning, like, he was a great friend to me. So he would mention each and everything, like how these factors change, how these videos, like this was like a time series data. And that helped me develop my current data that I'm working on for anomaly detection, because it has been indirectly helping me as in understanding what exactly should I segment. Like, if we just use the normal segmentation model that we normally do, like outlining the idea and the main object, it does not make sense from at least that application point, because we want to focus on other things. And the anomalies can vary because the shape of these things change a lot. And his domain knowledge helped me get a better idea over here. So yeah, sorry for the long plug, but as in, like, just adding to those things, like networking to people and talking to different from people from different domains helps the best. I think
university, being in a university is so stimulating for that, because there are so many people, like, in any area that you can think of in the on campus that are doing exciting work, right? And there are so many ways to, like, bridge and, like, talk to people outside of your area, and, you know, you can learn something very useful. And for sure, that this is the experience you were talking about. I think all of us have experienced some version of this, where, you know, we had a random conversation with somebody, and that, like, really opened up this avenue of, like, new research for you, or, like, just a new way of thinking about all the problems you were thinking about. So I really love doing this. Like, I love talking to people about the problem I'm working on, and I love hearing their perspective, because the immediate reaction they have, sometimes they'll connect with something they have seen, and yeah, or they, you know, I they will tell me a problem, I'll connect it with something, and that this really helps. Like, this is how collaborations also start, right? So it's always useful to, like, you know, just go sometimes just ask questions. If you don't know, you don't have anything to say, ask them about what they are doing. Just And actually, that's just to plug in, like, you mentioned about my Learning Theory Alliance work. So we have on our website a page called, it's a resources. So if you go to letall.com, you can plug in the link. Yeah. You can go on the resources, and there are a bunch of presentations. And we did networking as one of the topics. So it has, like, some tips from people in, you know, successful people in academia who have given their tips on how they went through and how did they do networking, and even tips on applying for a PhD, and you know, all kinds of resources that are, they are specific to more learning theory community, but actually most of the tips are pretty general. They're also tips about writing research statements, you know, being a successful PhD student. There's something about how to keep a track of papers also, or reading papers. You know, some resources on that. So I would recommend, like, checking them out. There are a lot of resources outside of what we have there available all over the internet. So, like, you know, whatever you need, just search, you will find some resources.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely going to plug that thing over here. So yeah, for anyone who's, I think I went through, like when we first connected, I went through all of these resources and they are fantastic. Like I downloaded at least a few of them on my local disk over here. And I'm going to look through, like, at least I think there was one presentation, I'm forgetting the presenter or something, but I downloaded the presentation and on my flight to India, like I was reading that particular thing. So yeah, it's a great resource for sure. So I'm going to plug that in for anyone. And since most of the audience I have is like people who are interested in research and being like they are young students, so it would be very useful.
Yeah, definitely. So, there are some that are targeted for undergrads, and there are some targeted for PhD students and postdocs. So there's like all kinds of resources. So you should be able to find something that's useful. And you know, you can also suggest us some topics that you think we have not covered, and we can add that as like our next workshop.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And coming to the other topic is like one of the other scary parts for us as researchers is like what happens once we have done our stuff, either as a master's or PhD student, is the job interviews, right? So like, can you shed more light on, because this is something lesser known, because it's very well known if you are like into the common trajectory path of doing software development, people know what to expect, what levels of difficulties. There's a whole repository of questions that you can refer for your training and all those things. But after doing a PhD, it's very lesser known. What exactly would the interview process look like? Like what exactly does a machine learning scientist in engineer interview something looks like, or maybe a research scientist at XYZ company looks like? So I'm not sure if you went through like the industry based job interview process or academia or whichever you went through, can you share more insights what you should have in your portfolio apart from your resume? What should you be prepared for?
Yeah, so this varies a lot depending on which company you're applying to, or if you're in industry versus academia. So I only have experience with Microsoft Research, where I applied for a postdoc, and then I did academic job applications. During my PhD, I did internships at Google. So I have a little bit of an idea of how that works. So let me talk about industry first. So many companies only ask for your CV and they don't ask for anything else. And then you're supposed to like go through the programming interviews, and then a lot of interviews that are more on research, and they can be of different flavors. Sometimes they can be technical on the topic that, you know, you are supposed to be, you know, an expert on. So they can be very technical interviews. So preparing for that is like knowing, you know, your backgrounds and your basic stuff. So that has like, you know, every different company has a different protocol, and usually the recruiter shares this with you. So you have an idea of what you're going to expect later. For the specific companies that I, so Microsoft Research, for instance, is more like an academic job. So it's very much like academic interviews. How it works is you apply, you submit your CV, you submit your research statement, and you submit letters of recommendation. So you need to submit about 3 or more letters of recommendation. And once you submit your application package, something similar is in academia. You have to submit in addition, like a teaching statement and a diversity statement. These are usually what package you prepare, and then you submit it. And then they evaluate this based on all of the content you've submitted. And then they invite you for an interview. And generally, the interview process looks very much like you go visit them for a day. You give a talk, which is on your research. This is called the job talk generally. So you prepare this for to be a broad audience talk, which means that you want everybody to understand this talk that you have. And you talk about, you know, what you have done and what you're going to do in the future, because they're hiring you for what you're going to do in the future, because you've already done what you've done. Right. So that's what you do. And then you have like one-on-one meetings with different people in that. So it could be in that research org, or it could be in that department. Right. So you have these meetings, and these meetings, they are kind of getting a sense of, sometimes they'll ask you questions about your research. Sometimes it'll be about, you know, what is common between us, and what can we, you know, work on together if you were to come here. Or they would just like, you know, want to know more about your research area, because they might be outside. Like, say you and I are chatting. You were asking me questions about my research, and I would ask you questions about your research, because we are curious to understand what each other is doing, right? So these are like usually the style of, sometimes they can be more, you know, they can vary. Like sometimes they're very friendly, sometimes they can be more adversarial. So it depends on who's interviewing you. But it's actually a really fun experience, because there's only very rare opportunity you get to get one-on-one time with, you know, different researchers who are like doing like amazing work. And this is a great opportunity that you get to actually have one-on-one time where they're there to talk about your work. And this is very rare opportunity to get. So if you take the positive attitude towards it, even if you don't get the job, you get this opportunity that will always be good for you. So this is more for, you know, the research and academic positions. Industry, of course, works differently, and I might not be the best person to really talk about that because I've never really had a proper, outside of my postdoc, any other industry job. Yeah, so that is what I would recommend. Preparing for most of these kind of, after a PhD, a lot of why you're being recruited is for your work. And that is, you are an expert on your work. So you just need to know your work really well and maybe the related things that are happening and have a sense of what the community is doing in your space. So not just being focused entirely on your work, but like also in the broader community, what other things people are doing. Because these are useful things to know, because generally like the people you're going to be meeting or have some idea of what the community is doing. And if you have an idea, then this conversation becomes a lot easier.
Yeah, yeah. I think like once you're pitching your expertise area, like having an understanding of the whole landscape of that area makes more sense or appealing to when you are pitching yourself as a researcher, rather than just talking about your own three or four works that you have done and published. It would not make more sense. So like having a very broad understanding of that landscape, what are the challenges, what are the good things, bad things, and the future directions would make a lot more sense. So yeah, that.
Yeah, so it's a really fun conversation. I think interview always makes it sound scary, but you know, yeah, they're evaluating you, but they are also trying to get to know you. So it's always because they would want to hire you, right? Maybe they decide not to, but like they are trying to. So they're trying to explore as much what information they can get to decide to make this decision. Yeah.
Makes sense. But yeah, apart from that, like, I think these are the only things that I had. Like, apart from that, I guess I just have one last question is, in general, so if you were to recommend people any tips, so if he or she is into research, what would be the general tips that you would give to any researcher? Like, I'll keep it to computer science, but if you want to have any broad tips, that would be more than enough. Because we often find, like, as students, we are always trying to optimize some metric, right? Like, as a student, like, if you're in a master's or bachelor's degree, our metric is to optimize for CGPA or something like that. Versus in research, it's obviously these kind of very, like, I mean, you being a professor, it might not make more sense now, but as in, like, when we started off this PhD, our goal is to get as many paper, as many number of citations, and some kind of these metrics, which might not have any relevance in the real world, but we still tend to optimize for these things. Like, I want to have more citations and other kind of, like, I don't know if that makes any real sense or not, but these kind of things we try to focus on, and rather than focusing on actual work or actual research, fundamental research. So do you have any tips along these lines? What should be the end goal? Like, I mean, some kind, I know that there could be some Zen motivation coming from you over in these topics, but feel free to give that, like, as in, what should be the end goal that we should be focused on?
Yeah, so I'll probably reiterate what I said, that you know, you should enjoy the journey. So you know, you can get to a destination, but if you didn't enjoy the journey, then that destination will not feel good either. So even if you, like, you know, you spend all your time in your PhD worrying about how many papers and how many citations you got, and when you get them, you'd be like, okay, what did I do in the last 5 years? Why was I like stressing so much about it? You know, I didn't really enjoy what I was doing. And then you would have this existential crisis of like, why did I do what I did? So instead, like, it's better to like always optimize on enjoying your journey, learning more, you know. It's being in the moment is very important. I think you appreciate it. It's very easy to say for me right now. Even right now, even I struggle with all these questions, right? Like, I'm starting a new position. I'm like wondering about how many things I need to be trying to do and what should I be good at. And like, this is always a struggle with yourself. But don't forget to enjoy the part that you are doing, because later you'll look back and you'll only remember the parts that you had fun while you were doing this. You won't remember anything else. So definitely enjoy your journey. Spend time on things that actually make you, you know, you know what makes you curious. You know, take that time out. Maybe it'll hamper your productivity a little bit, but that time that you spend on learning something new might actually help you, benefit you later in life that you don't really know, because in short-sightedness might not help. Like, you know, you're spending a huge chunk of your time. So think about a long-term benefit or whatever you're learning right now, because that time is very hard to get again. You only get busier as you grow through this journey. So spend time on that. And be okay and nice to yourself, because failure is a very important part you have to get used to as a PhD student or as a researcher, because you do fail. Mostly, often 90% of your ideas don't work. It's the 10% that work. So you have to be okay with failure, and failure is just a sign that you can improve and you can do, you know, the next thing is what you can do. So I think that being kinder to yourself on failures and not being able to achieve the goals that you set for yourself, this happens, you have to be kinder to yourself about these and, you know, keep your momentum that, you know, you're still doing well. Remind yourself what the good things you've been doing and not, you know, like put all your energy into the one thing that you didn't achieve. So I think that's very important. And what helped me do this during my PhD, because I also had like very low moments where I was like, why I'm not doing anything good. And I wasn't used to failure because I, before that time in my life, I had not actually experienced real failure, which is very lucky for me. But now I was like, okay, I'm not able to do certain things. And this is all very overwhelming and new. And what really helps is like having, you know, the support circle around you. So invest in that support circle, be there for your friends who are peers who are going through this process, and let them be there for you when you need them. And I think the benefit of this is if you stay in this academic sphere, these are the peers you will interact with for the rest of your life, because they'll be in the circles that you are. So all this, having that support circle is very important. And, you know, taking all the resources, talking to all the mentors that you have, whenever you struggle, having, you know, reaching out that you're not the only one who's struggling, everybody struggles. So reaching out and all that, that is pretty useful. It's easy to say now, in that moment, it feels very hard to do, but like, you know, pushing yourself to do it is very important. And outside that, I said, networking is very important. Being okay to, you know, talk to people, reach out and put yourself out there. Even if it sometimes doesn't work out, doesn't matter, because if the days it works out, it'll give you such a big boost that it'll cover up for everything that it didn't work out on. And, you know, just take the opportunities that you can get and create them for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's a lot to pack in, but I think all of these things definitely make sense. So yeah, thanks a lot for sharing these things. And one question I actually had, like I had, which we forgot to cover, is like, I think your transition to being a professor, like what was your thought process? I think we did cover like the decision making process before going into PhD. I think that's also a big one. Like, what was the factors that you considered not going for a research job in industry, even though I think there's an obvious pay gap that we already know, like academia versus industry. So considering all these factors, like what were the factors that you considered becoming a professor?
Yeah. So this was not, it's always a challenging decision to make, you know, because you're making a big decision, which will affect the rest of a large part of your life. So of course I thought a lot about it. I enjoyed my experience in the industry lab as well, because I spent 2.5 years at Microsoft Research, which was great. But something that I really felt like I missed out and which I really enjoyed was interactions with students and, you know, like having a role, having that energy around you and having a role in, like, you know, maybe improving their lives in some form or the other. That kind of satisfaction was very important for me. And somehow like that always the best parts of the job I liked at Microsoft Research was also interacting with the interns. Of course, my colleagues were amazing and I loved interacting with them, but the students, just like that was just really exciting for me. And I was like, if this is what makes me very happy, then academic job is what I want to do. And I have actually, since I've joined, that this is what I've appreciated a lot, where, you know, my door is open. Sometimes students just walk in and talk to me. And it's like really interesting and really exciting to be able to have some kind of, you know, influence, maybe hopefully positive on them. And, you know, working with them is very exciting. They have all kinds of new ideas and things that are, you know, sometimes I've been in this field too long that I sometimes have like a set of ideas, and then somebody new is like so fresh. So it's very exciting. And generally in academic life, like I have so many people here in the university who are working on these exciting things, and I can talk to people outside in different departments who are doing really cool things. And I feel like I can now, you know, I have the opportunity to expand and do like really cool things with people around in this space. So it's that's kind of what my motivation is to be here. And maybe in a couple of years, I will have like a better perspective. I just started. So I have just done this for like a month and a half so far.
Yeah, I mean, that makes complete sense. And I think, frankly, from my perspective, like when I joined PhD program, I was the least person who would ever say that I want to become a professor. But half year into my curriculum as a PhD student, I'm much more inclined going in academia. I'm not sure about the other trade-offs that might factor in when I actually apply for these jobs. But I definitely find more interesting, like as in like like the mental tussle that you have working on these problems are much more rewarding rather than getting like working in industry. Of course, they're working on fantastic projects, but the idea of like brainstorming with different groups, like collaborating with so many people from different institutes, universities, and like nonprofit organizations that make it more interesting. And the idea of writing grants and the whole academic game is really interesting, like much more rewarding in terms of the thought process. So yeah, like,
yeah, I think, all of this is like, there are many factors that come into it. Like you said, like when you're making this decision, there's a lot of factors that come in and everybody has their own taste. So nobody should feel pressured to do either this or that, whatever they like. But both jobs have like their perks and both jobs have their challenges. You got to choose what challenges you're okay with.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I hope you do join academia and you continue to do this great work of recording these podcasts and making many people come into our academic spheres.
Yeah. I mean, that's my aim too, but I'm not sure if I'm cut out for being a professor or academic. I don't feel I have the traits to becoming that kind of person or having that much motivation. Like when I see my professor at whatever age she's doing, like, I don't know if I have that much motivation or energy in my life to be dedicated onto a problem and training newbies like me who are frankly much more under experienced or under trained. So it's her patience. I think she lives with us. So I don't know if I have that patience.
It always feels like this. Like, I mean, I when I was at your stage, I also felt like, how would I be able to do all this? And you know how, but it's kind of like once you take a role, you fit into it. Like when you started your PhD, you're like, how will I be a PhD student? I can come up with all these things. It's like just a journey. Like everybody starts out not knowing what they're doing and they learn in the process. I'm probably gonna I'm gonna learn so many new things. I'm already learning so many new things, and hopefully I'll get to that stage where, you know, my student will say this, that how does she, you know, like she can do all this and, you know, I can't do all this. And then I'll tell them that, you know, I didn't know anything when I started either. So so you can totally do it. Like, just believe in yourself.
I'll keep that word for sure. But on that note, I think those were the questions I had. So I think we get to cover from a very background perspective of your interest in AI to, I think, what your current work has been. And even a separate podcast on that would be something too much, we can dig much more deeper onto those topics. But it was good to cover, I think, the theoretical aspects, what it means and what do some of the works on Transformers and other latest trending architectures have been doing, and also some great insights on student life, graduate life, which is very useful, at least to me. I'm sure the listeners to this particular podcast also find that interesting, but I'll be linking to all the web pages that they can find information. So at least your group, and also some works that you have done as a researcher, so that they can get in touch with them. But apart from that, thanks once again being on the show. I think hopefully we'll connect more in the future for these kind of information sharing sessions. But thanks for being on the show and sharing your insights.
Thank you so much for having me. And it was really great chatting with you, and wish you all the best for your PhD and for this podcast as well.